Hello and welcome to the Not Alone Podcast. I'm Jason Moitoso.
And I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And we're back to wrap up and to talk about, for some reason, there's still something to talk about, our Miracle of the Sun.
Well, kind of. We are done with the Miracle of the Sun. I hope that makes you happy.
It's so fabulous.
I hope it makes other people sad.
I've been staring into that for much too long.
The sun?
The sun.
The miracle of the sun.
The miracle that is the sun.
And so thus you have pierced through the miracle and stared directly into the sun, and now you have UV damage in your eyes, right?
Perfect. Exactly.
Or you saw something beyond the realm of human comprehension. Either way, that's over now.
Yeah. We're done with that. So then why are we here?
Yeah. Well, for one thing, we're here because we're going to do this every week now. We're back to doing this every week.
Okay.
So that's, you're just going to be here.
Yeah, yeah.
But on a much more real sense, the reason why we are still here in the space of the kind of religious miracle realm that we're currently in,
right,
is because Not Alone has become something more than what it was. It's not less than what it used to be, but it's something more. And that something more is more educational, I think. Still entertaining, still funny, still stupid, but more educational is okay. What I'm trying to go for here. So I thought a wonderful way of doing that, I might be wrong, was to give a brief overview of kind of the history and the idea of Marian apparition and miracles, and talk about how the Catholic Church verifies such miracles and the like.
Okay, sure. So first off, like, how many miracles have there been?
Like thousands. Like thousands. A good ballpark number, well, let me think here, would be at least 20,000. So there's that.
Where's my miracle?
Yep. Yep.
Where's your miracle? Have you had a miracle?
I've had a miracle.
Oh.
But you can go find your own.
Okay.
Now.
Don't they just kind of find you?
We'll talk about
okay.
that. So the first thing I want to talk about, we'll talk about miracles in kind of the second half. More generally, but the first thing I want to do is talk about a brief history of Marian apparitions to begin with.
That's fair.
Sounds good?
Yeah, sounds great.
Anything you got? Anything you want to say?
No, I mean, we first talked about them, and they're primarily a Catholic thing.
Primarily. But, and I think I said, erroneously, that they were an exclusively Catholic thing. I was wrong, and I'm sorry I was wrong.
Hey. At least you're airing that now.
Yes. Instead of years from now.
And this then is the somebody only time calls me out on Twitter. Going to say that he's wrong.
That's not true. I say I'm wrong all the time. I am wrong all the time. Well, that's true.
Yeah.
Why would I? That's just opening myself up for all sorts of things.
That is the Pandora's box.
Yes. Now, Marian apparitions.
I thought you were about to do a Jedi mind trick on me.
Woo! Marian apparitions. Holy. They come from a very long time ago. The year was 4080, which is funny because Mary herself didn't actually die traditionally until, and again, quote unquote, die, because that's a whole thing, traditionally until 41 AD.
Well, if it's that close, are we sure that there wasn't a mistake in dating?
Certain. Quite certain.
100%?
Yeah.
Okay.
Again, traditionally. This is all tradition.
Okay.
This last time we did this amazing thing where pretty much the entire episode was sourced from first person accounts. This time, all of our accounts come from hundreds of years later.
Perfect.
So that's what we've got going for
usable material.
But there's no need to doubt it. There's no reason not to believe it, I would say. So Mary,
I hope that we will one day be that source. Hundreds of years from
Holy
now.
Holy crap.
Isn't that terrifying?
Tell me that people aren't going to listen to this in 300 years. Oh my God, I'm immortal. Wow.
Hopefully.
We did it, Twitter!
If we don't all perish.
Which we will.
Yeah, probably. So,
but even then, maybe one day, something will find my laptop. It will. I'll do this. If there is a threat of impending nuclear doom, I'll take the password off my laptop. Only if that's the case. And then something can find it, open it up, plug it in. I will duct tape the charger to it so that way they've got it.
Just find an outlet, plug it into the wall,
plug it in.
Fire that bad boy up.
And fine, you're right. Maybe I should buy one of those power packs. That's what I'll do.
Those drain over time anyway, Sam.
Yeah, I guess.
That's the nature of batteries.
That's true. And they will plug it in, and they'll boot it up, and they'll find my folder that's called Completed Episodes, and they'll find every Not Alone episode there. And they'll listen to it, and they'll be like, what is going on? And then, because we reference so much cultural and historical context, they will be able to reconstruct a primitive history of planet Earth and its inhabitants before the nuclear holocaust from us.
Wouldn't that be such an inaccurate history?
Yeah.
Be like, wow, these people were wild.
Oh my God, this is it. If you're listening.
There is dogmen running in the streets.
If you're listening, 300 years from now.
Time capsule it, Sam.
Everything we've said is bullshit. None of this is real. It's all crap. Do not rewrite your history books around this. But they won't believe it. They'll say they were having a moment of doubt. They were trying to throw us off the trail. The future has big things for us. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, good.
Okay. Oh, no. I fell. Woo.
All right. Maybe we shouldn't record back-to-back
episodes. I love it. It really gets the creative juices flowing.
Sure.
Now, Marian apparitions.
Yes.
We can talk about the future.
Because our source material is old.
Yes. We'll talk about the future in the future.
Much removed from the actual occurrence.
Yes.
Got it. Perfect.
Again, this is all tradition.
Yes.
Well, most of it's tradition. Later on, we'll be getting into some more actual dates and facts and figures. But Marian apparitions have been around for as long as Mary herself. Longer than Mary's post-living state, whatever it may be. The first apparition was reported in the year 40 AD, or supposedly comes from the year 40 AD, which is just 12 to 7 years after the crucifixion. The earliest written tradition of Mary's death, which you may remember from our previous episodes in the Catholic Mariology, is not a death, but rather an assumption bodily into heaven, is 41 AD. This source comes from the 7th century, a man named Hippolytus of Thebes. Devotion to Mary as a source of protection and thought of as an intercessor for individuals has roots as far back verifiably as 250 AD, with a text called Sub Tuum Praesidium, or Beneath Thy Protection. The thy, in this case, is Mary. So, we also have, we'll get there. So, we have good reason to believe that people have been praying to Mary for intercession since around 250 AD. It could be, give or take a few hundred years. But it is a ancient practice. So there's that. Now, the text of Sub Tuum Praesidium is as follows, quote, "Beneath your compassion we take refuge, O Theotokos. Do not despise our petitions in times of trouble, but rescue us from dangers, only pure, only blessed one." Now, if this is literally the earliest reference to Mary as protector ever created, then it would still be a pretty good argument that Marian devotion was a foundational component of the early church. But as most students of history can tell you, there's almost no way this is the first time someone attributed such responsibilities and abilities to Mary. For one thing, it would be completely ridiculously improbable that the first such record created was the one that survived to the modern day. For instance, the oldest copy we have of the earliest gospel, which is Mark, we have it from around 150 AD, which is anywhere from 70 to 90 years after most scholars believe it to have been written. Thus, it is not beyond belief that such prayers and hymns of protection would be older than 250 AD. All of that aside, which I put in mainly because Marian devotion is extremely fascinating to me, the earliest reported Marian apparition does come before Mary's death or bodily assumption. The story, handed down from tradition, goes that the Apostle James was evangelizing in Roman Hispania, or modern-day Spain. specifically in the area of what would later be known as Zaragoza, which longtime listeners will remember as the place with the talking stove. Do you remember that?
No.
Do you remember that? It was basically like a Jeff 2.0 situation.
I hate it.
The stove talked.
Nope.
It was great.
It did not.
Now, James, the evangelist, he was feeling particularly discouraged. It was at that point that Mary appeared, accompanied by a host of angels standing atop a pillar. She encouraged him to his work, then she disappeared. Some early church sources claim that this is not...
Wait, was that just mom telling me to do my homework?
Pretty much is essentially what it is. You're fine. Okay. You've got this. Let me know if you need any help. The reason why we have good idea to believe that this is not simply that one person says it was 40 AD, the other person said it was 41, and they just got these switched, is that the church uses this as a case not of apparition, so to speak, but rather of bilocation, a person literally being in two places at the same time. Elsewise, it is also claimed the angels took Mary from Jerusalem, ferried her to Zaragoza, and then brought her back again. So
that's an entourage.
Yeah. The way that the early church talks about it, this was...
Wait, why is this guy so special?
James?
Yeah.
James is a... He's James.
Okay.
He's one of the original 12...
Right, right. No, I understand. But I mean, it seems like a long trip.
Well, yeah, I guess. That's fair.
Okay. He's... Just to tell him to do his work.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
A letter would suffice.
Well, how are you going to get a letter to him? He's going as west as he can, as fast as he can. You're going to send a runner with a letter that says, hey?
No, a horse.
How would she even know? How would she even know that he needed such encouragement?
Moms always do.
That's true. Anyway, it's by location.
Okay.
Is the first account. And we have... I'll say a good reason to, a good reason to give credence to this idea that Mary was somehow involved in strengthening James, or that message came across very early, because tombs of very early Christians in Spain bear some of the earliest evidence, some inscriptions of Marian protection and asking and depictions of Mary and the like. So,
okay.
Spain, very ancient area as far as that goes. Now, there have been untold numbers of apparitions throughout history. Some estimate the count being near 2,500. But it was not until the last 500 years or so that the church began verifying and quote-unquote approving apparitions. Amongst these, there are a handful of which that have been foundational and extremely compelling. The first recorded of such variations, or of such apparitions, is Our Lady of Guadalupe, one of the most famous and culturally significant Marian apparitions of all times. Have you ever seen...
No.
Okay. So, you know there are like candles, right? And the candles have like saints on them?
Yes.
Okay. Have you seen the one of Mary, and it's kind of, she's like kind of looking downwards... And she's in a cloak, and it's
sounds
got
familiar,
like something
yeah.
around. It's a very, very, and candles is not the right, it's the only thing I could think of, but it's everywhere. It's all over the place.
Okay.
Our Lady of Guadalupe is one of the most culturally significant because it led to basically the evangelization of all of Mexico. So it is quite literally one of the main reasons that Mexico remains such a and all of Central America remains
Catholic.
Such a Catholic country and was to begin with. Now, these apparitions... Huh.
After the plague killed everything else.
Well, that's true. Dude, oh my gosh. In my... what class was it? It was either... I think it was Western Civ. I watched this video about why that happened and like why the Europeans had plagues and why the Native Americans did not have plagues, and how them having plagues like basically destroyed the European population in such a way that only people who were resistant to the plagues survived.
Right.
And then they were just their bombs. Yeah. Oh,
same thing with dogs.
What about them?
There's only like, there's not even a true lineage of American dogs anymore. The Chihuahuas, it has a closer lineage to European ancestry than it does to like American.
So you're saying that as opposed to wolves being domesticated here, we brought over the domesticated dogs?
Both. We domesticated wolves here.
Mm-hmm.
And we domesticated in England, or in Europe.
Okay.
The European species also had more diseases than the American.
Oh, no, they killed all the dogs.
So when they brought over European dogs, it actually ended up killing a lot of the American dogs. There is an Inuit wool dog that was a little dog bred specifically for its wool. And apparently, like, the blanket is like worth more than slaves in that culture.
Could
you imagine the fluffiest dog in the world is probably that one.
This sucks, guys.
And then Conquest killed that too.
Conquest just sucks, man.
Mm, well, we like things.
That's true.
Now we've just transformed into consumerism.
Now these
and sporting events.
These apparitions.
Yeah, sorry.
They revolve around Saint Juan Diego, who is the first indigenous saint from the New World. The story goes that Juan Diego, who was an Aztec, was born in 1474, and he encountered the Virgin Mary a number of times. Most famously, when his uncle was dying, she promised to take care of him, to heal him, and then arranged flowers in his tilma, or cloak. So here we have an apparition, which is actually quite rare, that she's making physical contact. She's touching right. And being touched. But these flowers, okay, so she arranges them in his cloak. He goes and shows himself to the local bishop after he confirms his uncle's miraculous healing. He opens his coat, the flowers fall out, and they reveal the image of the woman that he had seen. This image that's been revealed is the image that is on everything. It is not a representation of it. It is not like... It's just crazy.
It's a recreation of it.
It is the image. So like, because I kind of thought, have you ever seen pictures of the Shroud of Turin?
No.
So the Shroud of Turin is this probably fake, but maybe not, but I'm pretty sure it's fake. And most people are. Linen that was supposedly laid over Jesus.
Oh, that.
And
yes.
You've got like the imprint of the face. And right. It's a recognizable imprint of a face. Like you can see where it is. That's kind of what I thought this was. This is the full color image itself is what was just miraculously imprinted on the cloak. The cloak has been preserved and now resides in the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City. The apparition of the Virgin and the physical evidence that was left behind paved the way for the evangelization and conversion of, this is an old-timey estimate, and we know how reliable those are, but of 2 million people. So at the very least, it was still a lot of people.
Right.
Again, most of them, almost all of them Aztecs or other indigenous people groups before all of that happened. So that's one thing. Something miraculous and really spectacular about the cloak. It is, of course, nigh to impossible to actually confirm 500 years later that it is the same tilma, the same cloak. Yet, it has been in this location for hundreds of years. There is a very, very interesting, and I'll link to it in the show note, a very interesting study that was done. The picture itself of the Virgin, her eyes are basically closed. You can only see just a little bit of them, just little black slits, basically. And upon massive magnification, they were able to find I think the reflections of seven distinct individuals in the eyes themselves.
So this is gigantic.
No.
No.
It's a normal cloak. What? That's
the out of thing. Flowers, though.
The flowers were there. They fell away, and then the image appeared.
Okay, I'm following.
Yeah, yeah. But still, on this normal-sized cloak with just a tiny little sliver of eye, if you zoom in enough, you see like seven or even more people reflected in the eyes of the image, which is just crazy. It's crazy. It's crazy.
It's pretty wild.
It's wild. So that is the first foundational event after like the Middle Ages and stuff that has been verified as a genuine apparition. And of course, its main purpose was evangelization, which is what we see in Fatima. Oh my God. Fatima. How do you say it? Jason, help me.
Fatima? Yeah.
Okay. That is what we see in Fatima as well. There is the component of the end of the war, yet a big part, the reason why we're sending this miracle, the apparition says, is so that all may see and believe. So there's the beginning of a thread that runs through all of this. Another important apparition was the apparition of Our Lady of Lourdes. Our Lady of Lourdes was a Marian event that included some 18 apparitions between February 1858 and July 1858 in Lourdes, France. What?
That's some high frequency.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot. Most of it was daily. For a good part there, it was like daily for like 15 straight days. And then it was nothing for a few months. And then like one last one a few months later, because the government got wind of it and they tried to suppress it and cover it up. They like, well, we'll talk about it.
How do you cover up?
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
Now in this case, a young woman named Bernadette Soubirous, she was gathering firewood with her sister and a friend when she saw a, quote, small young lady, unquote. Okay. So this is, I kind of alluded to it last episode, it's not uncommon for apparitions to be smaller than normal.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's that. The lady did not speak, but Bernadette, for reasons that she could not understand, was drawn to return to the same spot. She did so, and after praying the rosary, the lady appeared again. Bernadette threw holy water on the apparition in order to make sure it was not an evil spirit.
Whoa, so she interacted with the apparition.
Yeah, she like, and the apparition like gets soaked and just like smiles. She's like, okay, we're good.
Okay.
Because it's just, well, and it's the same sort of thing as what did happen in Portugal is, she was talking to her local priest or pastor, and he had said, like, well, spirits can be evil, too, and seem like they're good. And so she tested it, just like happened with Lucy. But on the third trip, the apparition finally spoke. She didn't even speak after being doused with the water. And the apparition humbly requested that the girl return 15 times. In a similar fashion, the girl returned daily for, I think it was like 14 days, maybe it was closer to 12 or 13, and came back with a larger and larger group every time. They culminated in a miracle witnessed by the town doctor, who was skeptical of the whole affair, who said, quote, Bernadette seemed to be even more absorbed than usual in the appearance upon which her gaze was riveted. I witnessed, as did also everyone else there present, the fact which I am about to narrate. She was on her knees, saying with fervent devotion the prayers of her rosary, which she held in her left hand, while in her right was a large blessed candle, a light. The child was just beginning to make the usual ascent on her knees, when suddenly she stopped, and her right hand joining her left, the flame of the big candle passed between the fingers of the latter. Though fanned by a fairly strong breeze, the flame produced no effect upon the skin which it was touching. Astonished at this strange fact, I forbade anyone there to interfere, and taking my watch in my hand, I studied the phenomena attentively for a quarter of an hour. At the end of this time, Bernadette, still in her ecstasy, advanced to the upper part of the grotto, separating her hands. The flame thus ceased to touch her left hand. Bernadette finished her prayer, and the splendor of the transfiguration left her face. She rose and was about to quit the grotto when I asked her to show me her left hand. I examined it most carefully, but could not find the least trace of burning anywhere upon it. I then asked the person who was holding the candle to light it and give it to me. I put it in several times in succession under Bernadette's left hand, but she drew it away quickly, saying, "You are burning me." I record this fact just as I have seen it without attempting to explain it. Many persons who were present at the time can confirm what I have said. Unquote. So she's sticking her hand in fire for 15 minutes. There's no burning. There's no pain. There's no nothing. So that's pretty wild in and of itself.
Yeah.
Anything?
I mean, like,
again, this one's not necessarily a debate, but I'd just like to hear.
There's been numerous, like, accounts of people going through certain pains while experiencing a religious event and not feeling any pain or healing quickly from it as well. I mean, there's plenty of different ways that you can get around being burnt. One is just having a lot of water on your hand. But even still, like, it's tough to say from something like a candle.
And for 15 minutes.
15 minutes is a long time. Yeah. So it could have been something else that was coating her hand in order to kind of make that trick. Or, again, being at this level of religious
fervor
that she was not feeling the pain of it.
All right.
I don't know.
All right.
I mean, it's hard without, even though we have a fairly decent description of the events, it's hard without having like more physical information or evidence. Besides for just the fact that what candle it was, how far away her hand actually was from it originally, that kind of thing. Like, there's a lot of variables involved with it.
That's fair.
It's cool.
It is cool.
But so is people walking on coals.
That's true.
And that is pretty easily doable.
Yeah, that's fair. So the government gets involved. Like I said, there's just more people coming to the grotto. They barricade it is how they suppress it. So her last, it's either her last one or her last two or three visits there, they don't occur until months later, whereas the apparition had requested her presence consecutively over 15 days. But anyway, so similarly, after these events did conclude months later, Bernadette left to join a religious order, just like Lucy. And although it took a few years, the apparitions were verified. And decades later, Bernadette was canonized as a saint. Lourdes is also a destination for religious pilgrims, with it being one of the most frequently visited areas of tourism, of religious tourism, with some 6 million people visiting it every year. There have been dozens of miraculous healings. The very last count that I saw, but it may have gone up from there, is 70 confirmed healings out of a reported 8,000 that occurred from people who went to Lourdes looking to be healed. So, yet, and we'll talk about those in a minute, yet, Marian apparitions do not occur solely in the Roman Catholic Church. This is where I was wrong.
Ooh.
In the Coptic Orthodox Church, there are other distinct apparitions that have been approved of. The Coptic Church is a primarily Egyptian denomination. It is headquartered in Alexandria, Egypt. Now, whereas the Roman Catholic Church is traditionally built upon the Bishopric of Rome, whose first bishop was Saint Peter, the Coptic Church was established by Saint Mark, the evangelist who is best known for writing the first gospel. He was a traveling companion of Paul and close with Peter. So it's actually, or with Saint Peter. And so it's actually proposed that Saint Mark's gospel is in fact Peter's recollections of his time traveling with Jesus written down. So he was established his seat in Egypt as the bishop of Alexandria, and the Coptic Church then grew out of that. Now, the Coptic Church split from the Catholic Church after the Council of Chalcedon in 451 AD, making it the second church to split from the Church Universal, following the Church of the East, which split in 431. These splits were due to doctrinal differences, mainly Christological in nature. Yet, the devotion to Mary is alive and well in the Coptic Church as well, with many of the same dogmas such as the Assumption of Mary, the Immaculate Conception, and the Perpetual Virginity of Mary, and her intercession being accepted in the Coptic Orthodox Church. Out of the number of interesting apparitions that have been verified in the Coptic Church, most centering in Egypt, the one I found the most particularly compelling is Our Lady of Zeitoun. And I may be butchering that. I apologize. It's spelled Zeitoun. This was a 3-year event. It resulted in anywhere from 250,000 to up to 1 million people witnessing the apparition one way or the other. The event began in Cairo on the 2nd of April 1968. It began when Farouk Mohammed Atwa, a Muslim mechanic who was working across the street from St. Mary's Orthodox Coptic Church of Zeitoun, which is a suburb of Cairo, looked up and saw from the bus he was working on a beautiful young woman standing on the roof of the church. He pointed at her, pointing with a finger that had been infected with gangrene and was scheduled to be amputated.
Yep.
Quite quickly. He pointed at her with that gangrenous finger to a fellow workman. They called for help. A crowd gathered, all shouted up at the woman, who they believed to be suicidal and considering jumping, when she suddenly vanished from sight. The woman was reported from another vantage point as well, and the matter was reported to the police. The entire event lasted just a number of minutes, yet it was enough to sow the seeds of wonder into the minds of the observers who could not understand who the woman was to begin with, where she went, or what had happened to her. Even more interestingly, some people had reported seeing the woman glowing in a certain way. The next day, Farouk awoke and his gangrenous finger was healed. 1 week later, the figure reappeared in the same place. As with all the other apparitions, as she appeared more and more, she was witnessed, of course, by more and more people. The government of Egypt at the time was leaning toward socialist Marxism, and although the president Gamal Abdel Nasser was a Muslim, he strove for a secular government and social order. Thus, the apparitions alerted the local government, who conducted a full investigation in a 15-mile radius for any sort of equipment, lighting, transportational, sculptural, anything, and it came up completely empty. At one point, during an apparition, they initiated a blackout of the chapel and the surrounding area, cutting it off from the grid completely, and the apparition continued to shine without being disturbed. The events continued to appear in front of huge crowds of witnesses. There were also cited luminous doves whose purity could symbolize the Virgin, but have also traditionally served as an image for the Holy Spirit. It's interesting to note, I didn't put this in the note, it's interesting to note that Islam has a interesting relationship with Mary. She is mentioned more in the Quran than in the New Testament. She is also the only woman to be mentioned by name in the Quran itself. So she is held in a place of high honor in Islam as well. But of course, one of the main distinctions is that while Islam believes that Jesus was a great prophet, I believe the penultimate prophet to Muhammad himself, he was not anything more than
just a prophet.
Which
yeah,
is, of course, right. Not what the Catholics and Christianity believe. So I just find it really interesting that this happened in that area where 7 out of 10 individuals were Muslim at the time. So anyway, the matter was investigated by both the Roman Catholic Church and the Coptic Orthodox Church, with the cops sending Bishop Athanasius to investigate.
That's a name.
It is the name of a individual who formed, it's actually very interesting, he formed what's called the Athanasian Creed back, oh, I don't know, in like 400 AD, something like that. That's it's basically the official formulation of the Trinity and where the Trinity once and for all gets really spelled out as to what this means in the Catholic Church. So it is, it's quite a name with quite a legacy behind it. Now, his report of Bishop Athanasius, obviously not the same one from 400 AD, maybe.
Another apparition.
His report was thus, quote, "Suddenly there she was, standing in full figure. The crowd was tremendous."
But she was also small too, right?
She looked pretty normal. Okay. She looked normal sized. But again, she's on the roof, there on the ground.
Right,
yep.
Right.
And as we'll see, she was even higher than the roof in some cases. Quote, "Suddenly there she was, standing in full figure. The crowd was tremendous. It was too difficult to move among the people, but I worked my way to in front of the figure. There she was, 5 or 6 meters above the dome, high in the sky, full figure like a phosphorescent statue, but not stiff like a statue. There was movement of the body and clothing. Our Lady looked to the north. She waved her hand. She blessed the people, sometimes in the direction where she stood. Her garments swayed in the wind. She was quiet, full of glory. It was really something supernatural, very, very heavenly. Some people were praying in Greek. Others were reciting verses from the Quran. Others were singing Coptic hymns. I tried to distinguish the face and features, and there was something about the mouth and the eyes that I could see. And then the apparition slowly faded away," unquote. Honestly, we could do an entire another episode all about Our Lady of Zeton, because there is a lot. Like I said, it's a 3-year period. You even have President Nassar supposedly witnessing this as well in the audience. All sorts of things that happen there. Like I said, in Cairo, I said 7. It's actually 8. 8 out of 10 individuals are Muslim rather than Christian, which doesn't preclude their honoring Mary, but it does not, because she would have just been a very, very, very virtuous woman who bore a very, very virtuous man. There's not a lot of reason for Marian apparitions to occur in Islamic communities as much. So very interesting there. But it doesn't really fit that seeing what they wanted to see that you can say of Fatima and Lourdes. You know, you've got, we talked about it, the kids are pious. You've got in Lourdes a very pious individual there, and yet most of these witnesses,
as you've already
not
said, though, she is basically, she's the only named woman in the Quran, right?
That's true.
So that would be the only explanation.
That's true.
Of who it could possibly be, right?
Well, if we're thinking a religious figure, then yes. I would think so.
Okay.
I don't know everything there. That's actually my substantial blind spots that I'm trying to work on.
Okay. But hypothetically then, at this point in time, to our best knowledge, that if there was a womanly figure that is floating above something, that's who most of the people would probably assume it might be.
I think that's fair
potentially.
I think that's fair to say. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
There we, I mean, that's, I just cool. want to make that understanding.
I dig it.
Okay.
I dig it. Anyway, so one last interesting thing about it is that the chapel that she appeared upon, St. Mary's of Zeton, has for a very long time, the reason it's called St. Mary's is because it was actually seen or believed in tradition to be one of the places that the Holy Family stayed during their sojourn in Egypt when Jesus and his family lived as refugees, as described in the Gospel according to Matthew. Just as in the cases of Guadalupe and Fatima, oh my God, why can't I say this? Fatima. Okay. And Fatima, one of the major...
We could be saying it wrong the entire time, probably. Whatever.
One of the major effects of the apparitions was evangelization and conversion, which one may say seems to be the main cause for the apparitions in the first place. Hello, everybody. It's Sam here, coming at you with the mid-show break. It'll be a fairly quick one again this week, just because we reached out to a few different people to get promos to run their promo, and nobody responded. So whatever. That's fine. So all we're going to go ahead and do is just thank a few people, and then we'll get right back to the show. So firstly, we'd like to thank the individual who left us an iTunes review this last week. Our first one since the beginning of December, I think. So we really appreciate that. This person's name is Shibungi, and they say, "It's like you're there with them. What the title says, it's just like you're there with the hosts. Just two friends doing a podcast, a third wheel as an audience member. They're informative and entertaining to listen to, always showing us two sides of the coin. They could do a show on the Christian panic of Pokemon that occurred in the 1990s and the conspiracy behind it, and I would still listen to it. Sure, they can be a bit man-childish, but that's part of their appeal." Oh, thank you. We appreciate that. That's fantastic. So thank you so much for leaving that review. And remember, if you want to help out the show, that is a great way to help us out. Go rate us, review us on the podcast app, and that will definitely help us out. We also would like to thank a number of people who joined our Patreon this last week. We would like to thank Kenzie Fullwood. We'd like to thank David Rodriguez. And we'd like to thank Brianna, or Brianna. It's one of those. Guys, thank you so much. Your support means the world to us. It really keeps the lights on, keeps the show going. If you'd like to learn about how you can become a patron and get access to all sorts of fun, cool benefits and the like, you can do that at patreon.com/notalonepodcast. On that note, this month and this month only, we're actually going to upload our patron bonus episode to the standard feed next week. We're doing this for a number of reasons. The first one is I had planned to do this anyway, kind of as a reintroduction to, hey, if you're a patron, this is what you can look forward to. Because the last time we did that, first off, it was like 3 years ago, which, by the way, we just passed our 3-year anniversary this last week. Thank you all so much. Secondly, the last time that we did this and we did upload a Patreon preview, it was just me. It used to be that Jason did not do those bonus episodes with me. Now he does them. So we'll be uploading that next week, and that is going to be about the secret, the third secret, and the conspiracy that supports it or surrounds it from there. So, and then after that, we will be done with Fatima, Catholicism in general, for a very long time, at least a few months. And we will start talking about the great beast, the Prince of Darkness, Aleister Crowley. And we'll spend a month talking about him instead. So if you really loved this series, hopefully you'll love the next one. If you really didn't like this series, hopefully you'll love the next one. And either way, we'll be back at you again. We'll do that bonus episode next week. Oh, the other reason why we're releasing it next week is I forgot there were 5 weeks in January. I'm not even going to lie to you. I sat down, I planned out the first half of the year, planned it out with 4 episodes per month, and boom, there's 5 this month. So, but that's a secondary cause. Again, we were going to go ahead and replace it or release it either way, but I'm rambling. You're tired of hearing me ramble. Theoretically. So we're going to go ahead and we'll get back to the show. Thank you all so much, and take it away, Sam. There are other apparitions as well, dozens and dozens from around the world, both verified and not. And while it may be normal for areas closely associated with Abrahamic religion to be hotspots for these sorts of activities, even in the Far East, there have been reports of Marian apparitions, such as Our Lady of Akita in Akita, Japan. Our Lady of Akita also exemplified another interesting component of the apparition, which is participation by images of Mary in the miracles themselves. So, in Akita, there were messages that were given to a sister, Agnes Sasagawa. She was deaf. She heard a voice. The voice directed her to kneel in front of a wooden statue of Mary in the chapel in the convent that she was a part of. As she did, the statue was illuminated. The following day, the wooden statue was seen bleeding. The statue was bleeding. from a wound in its right hand. Sister Agnes also received this wound, which is known as stigmata. It is said to happen to the pious to mirror the wounds of Christ during the crucifixion. As far as I'm aware, and I could be wrong, I believe the earliest source of this or earliest account of this happening is Saint Francis of Assisi, who lived, I want to say, in the 11th century around then, the same one that the current Pope is named after or took his name after. The wounds of Saint Agnes and the statue did heal, but the statue would gush blood. I don't...
Like with pressure.
It's almost nonsensical to talk about, because it's a wooden statue, but it's gushing blood. It's very strange. This is something that happens not just in Akita, although I think it's probably best seen there, but blood as well as the next phenomena, which is tears, as the statue weeps. This is something that is also kind of universal when it comes to Marian apparitions. Not all of them do this, but there is precedent of it participating in statues and things like that as well. Or in other areas like Lourdes and Fatima, where statues are after the fact, after the apparition's installed, those statues have often been seen crying, or not crying, but tears coming out of their eyes. But the statue itself is not moving, it's not breathing, it's not anything like that. So after the wounds of Agnes and the statue were healed, and speaking of healing, Agnes received her hearing back after all of this. I don't know what caused her deafness in the first place. But she got it back, she lost it, and then it came back again for the rest of her life, which is interesting.
So wait, she didn't have it, got it back, lost it again, and then came back again.
Came back again forever. Yeah, it's very strange. After the healing of the wounds, the statue wept for 17 days straight. Its tears were salty. I don't want to know.
Who tasted it?
I don't know.
Who tasted her tears?
Somebody had to take one for the team in this one. I'm gonna be the guy.
A little salty.
They also exhibited a fragrant floral smell. The fluids were examined by a doctor and a biochemist named Professor Eiji Okuhara, who collected the samples himself from the statues and tested them himself, confirming that the blood and tears were of human origin. The tears, I don't know.
How do you make tears fragrant then?
Well, that's that. But I also don't know if tears, like, can you confirm that tears are human origin? Because they're just salt and water, right? There's probably some other biological marker. But
I mean, I'd assume that there's, like, some... Wouldn't there be, like, DNA floating around in
it,
too?
I guess that's true.
But if there's DNA floating around, that you could just match that with someone. Potentially.
Could. Well, and he did a full scientific workup on the blood as well, which, of course, would have also had DNA. And it was type B, the blood. The blood was type B blood.
It's weird.
It is weird. I don't know. And that's the thing about miracles. They're impossible. And they happen. Or supposedly. They allegedly happen.
I mean, the issue that I typically have is that you don't necessarily see a lot of further investigation than just kind of like this stuff.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
This is the part I kept falling asleep at.
Oh, good. I will link to in the show notes a massive catalog that just catalogs a huge amount of these events and these sightings. But I think we've done an all right job of kind of cataloging them here or characterizing them here. These apparitions, they're either bodily, they can be interacted with, they may only be seen, they may only be heard. There are cases where they are only heard, but those aren't really too verified. They encompass both physical objects and non-physical objects. They're very diverse overall, very diverse. But the point that Jason just made is my favorite point. Typically, when we hear about miracles, we hear about maybe... healing is a great one, and rightfully so to be skeptical of. So many healings, especially faith healings, which is a thing here in Idaho, not necessarily in Boise as much, but especially up north in other areas, you have people who eschew medicine to exclusively participate in faith healings.
Well, some of the problems, too, is that like when it happens, when a miracle happens mm-hmm. in healing, they're so few and far between that you can't collect a lot of data on them.
That's fair.
They don't happen frequently enough to where you can kind of associate things with.
That's fair. And they happen and everything's cool. And then like either days, weeks, months, or even years later, whatever they were healed from comes back. That's a common thing that happens in faith healings. So it's important to note that there is actually a verification process that goes into the miraculous process that is quite stringent. I mentioned it earlier. There are some 8,000 reported miraculous healings at Lourdes. There are only 70 that have actually been verified out of all of these. Now, in my opinion, personally, I would think if I was like, okay, taking this from a point of bad faith, which of assuming that like the organization is corrupt and that they're just trying to protect themselves or further faith so they can get more money or whatever, I would think that we would pretty much latch on to as many miracles as possible and be like, hey, guess what? 8,000 people have been healed here. But the church is actually very, very hesitant to label something a miracle, whether it's a healing or a genuine Marian apparition.
The cried wolf aspect as well.
Yeah.
If your religion keeps getting discredited, it's going to be tough to have new followers.
That is true. The list of unapproved Marian apparitions, at least, outnumbers the approved one, which we'll be linking to both, about 10-1, I would say.
That's fair.
The church seems to have a very stringent process by which events are verified.
I mean, I'm sure that every time someone has a piece of toast that looks like Jesus, it's probably not classified as a miracle, right?
No, it's not. That is true. The number of approved apparitions, like I just mentioned, is not particularly large. I think there's like 9 in the last century that have been approved out of, again, thousands. But the number of approved miracles in general are quite astounding. And the reason for this is because, as a rule, miracles are attributed to saints. So first, a quick overview of sainthood. While most of us... Well, Jason, what do you think? Did you read this far in the notes or did you fall asleep? You did?
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. I was going to ask you. But most of us think of a saint as just a really good person.
I thought of them as an exponentially pious individual.
Yes, yes.
That also probably was some sort of leadership role.
Yeah. Okay, good.
That's where I would have been like, ah, that's the making of a saint.
That's a saint right there. And, you know, you can never have a saint while they're alive. There are no living saints. They're all dead.
I did not know that.
Yeah. And the reason for that is a saint is more than, they are not less than, but they are more than just a really good person or a very pious person. A saint is someone who is currently in heaven with God. That is the technical definition of a saint. So when we talk about the process of canonization or the making of someone a saint, it is not necessarily that the church declares and says, hey, this person is a saint because I say they're a saint. They're a saint because there is sufficient evidence for the church, which this is just so fun to say in like a post-Enlightenment world because of the social connotation. There is enough evidence for the church to say that this person is in heaven with God. They have the evidence for it, which I just think is
kind of
an awesome thing to say, like even if it's completely crazy to you or you're like don't believe in it at all. I just think it's awesome. A saint is one who has died and is currently enjoying the beatific vision, which is the perfect, ultimate, and complete communion with God that occurs upon the death of the righteous. Because one is therefore in the presence of God, they are able to intercede for others here on earth. This intercession will then result in a miracle. Thus, each saint, and there are about approximately, this is almost
certainly... So do saints create more saints?
Ooh, what? No. No.
Saints perform miracles.
Yes.
Thus, experiencing a miracle...
Okay.
...leads to more religious...
It could move you to piety, which then could create a saint. Yeah, yeah, it could be a positive feedback loop. I love it.
Okay.
I love it.
I just... So there has to be a saint originally to create miracles.
Sure. That would be Jesus.
That, I mean, that makes sense.
Yes.
But you understand where I'm kind of going with this, is that the more saints there are, the more miracles theoretically that should happen?
Yeah, exactly. That's fair. That's totally fair to say. That's theologically sound.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay.
So.
Interesting.
Yes. So.
So then why is Mary around?
And of course, well, Mary is around because she's Jesus's mother.
I get that. But I mean, if we have so many other saints, why is she still doing all the heavy lifting?
She's not doing all the heavy lifting, but she is the closest to her son out of any human that's ever lived. The closest would be their mother. And there's actually, like, in the Bible, I'm sure I'm going to get a letter from a Protestant. And guys, I am a Protestant. I understand. It's fine. I'm sure I'm going to get a letter from a Protestant. There is in the Bible a point when Jesus is not going to do something, and then his mother makes him, and he does it. It's at the wedding in Cana where he turns the water into wine. She's like, hey, help this dude out. And he's like, nah, I'm not doing that.
Mom just wants to get the party lit.
And then she says, you need to do this. And he does it. So it's that same kind of idea, is that Mary is right there with Jesus, bringing your prayers to him. Now, this doesn't mean that Catholics don't pray directly to God or directly to Jesus or anything like that. It simply means the same way that if I had a friend who believed in God, if I would ask that person to pray for me because I believed that their prayers would do something additional to what my own would do.
Okay.
So does that explain? That is a short, concise explanation of Marian devotion.
Perfect.
Mary is the one who does the most, but the saints, you've heard of the patron saints, right?
Right.
Very common concept. So the saints, if you are one of these people, you pray to one of these saints because they are human beings who had specific passions and talents in their life that make them the best suited to intercede on your behalf.
Okay.
So St. Christopher, patron saint of travelers, if you're going on a journey, you would invoke him and he would say, hey, just make sure everything's good. And God would be like, all right, unless God says no. And then you die. And that happens sometimes. We're getting in the weeds.
Anyway, so aliens, right?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so...
ghosts.
So, for each saint, there is at least one miracle, but more often than not, two miracles. There are somewhere around an estimated 10,000 saints. Therefore, there are at least 20,000 miracles, but even then, that's not... there's more than that. 99.9% of these miracles, well, okay, that's an exaggeration. 95% in a limited case study were medical miracles. Now, the saint has to perform two of these. Once they go through this verification process, the individual is then canonized so long as some other requirements have been met.
So they have to experience or they have produce
to, it has
miracles.
To be that during, after a person has died,
yes.
Let's take Pope John Paul II, one of the fastest canonizations of all time. Pope John Paul II, I think it only took him like 7 years. Typically, there's a 5-year waiting period to even get started. But he died. He died, and when he died, some individuals, the majority of the Catholic Church, believed that he was a saint already. Because he was such a pious and holy person.
Okay.
So whether it's a pope or whether it's a little shepherd girl, Jacinta, their life exhibited a behavior in such a way that a person living now has good reason to believe that they should have God's ear on something. The person then prays only to that individual. Maybe you can also pray, I would think, also to like God himself or Mary. But even then, I'm not sure. They pray specifically through that one saint. So Pope John Paul II or Jacinta, some individual prays just to them for a specific ailment. That ailment is then miraculously healed, which we'll talk about that legal, well, not legal, but that definition.
Yep.
This happens twice, and that person is considered for sainthood from there.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay, cool. It's actually a 4-step process, but we're not going to get into all that. So the church simply acknowledges that these people are in heaven. They're not moving anyone to heaven. They're not saying who gets in or out. They're just saying they're there. And so when the Pope proclaims a new saint, he simply says discernimus, which means we recognize it in Latin.
Okay.
Yet there is much more that goes into the recognition of these miracles and their performers than simply healing someone that claimed they were sick and now they're not, and then just running with it. The first thing is you have to have a biography made of your life, and it has to be shown that you are saintly in every respect. Again, this is pretty common sense. It also makes sense because if you weren't, people wouldn't pray to you before you were a saint. Also starts out, you basically move from a local area of recognition to an international or universal area of recognition. For instance, it's totally fine for you. Let's say I died. No, not me. Let's say somebody in your life very close to you in this area died. You were a Catholic. They were a Catholic. They died. You pray to that person. Anybody in your parish here, your administrative area, would be allowed to pray to that person just fine. Anybody outside of the parish, not so much. In big cases,
it's just more taboo in general?
Well, in big cases like somebody like JP2 or other very famous people, Mother Teresa, it would make more sense. But right. Like if there's some guy in Caldwell that's really good and he dies, I'm probably not going to know about him. And if I do know about him and pray to him, it's not the end of the world, but it's just not supposed to really happen outside of a specific smaller area.
So then aren't you kind of basically worshiping them over God?
No, not necessarily. This is the Protestants.
That's where things get like really fuzzy.
This is
right?
Where it all gets very fuzzy. I've done a lot of research. I don't think that's what's happening. But in any case, it moves from that smaller circle, and then through each one of the four steps of the process, the circle gets bigger. Okay. More people, they gain renown, more people pray to them. There's a higher chance of them becoming a saint because more people are praying to them. Until finally a universal recognition where then all people are allowed not only to pray to them, but also you can erect churches in their honor, like okay. St. Mark, St. Mary's, that sort of a thing from there. So lots of technical details here, which is what everybody loves. Now, you have a saintly biography compiled. You've done that. Okay. That's step one. You're, I believe, a servant of God is at that point is typically what it's called. This biography is usually compiled by it's something called like the Committee for the Causes of the Saints. Then once miracles come, the Vatican retains 100 trained physicians and scientists, known as the Consulta Medica, to examine cases of so-called miraculous healings. In addition to this council seeking to find the truth, there is another that is led by a man called the Promoter of the Faith, who is commonly known as the Devil's Advocate, and is the origin of the term the Devil's Advocate, who does exactly what we would expect they would do. They raise each and every objection they can in order to undermine both the character of the person in life and the miracles they performed in death. This was previously a position that was held by Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict XVI, who abdicated to Pope Francis, who we have today. So you only get it if you're a very smart person, very bright person who can think about all the reasons why this couldn't happen. So Jason, you would be perfect for this.
No, I wouldn't.
We just need you to be a cardinal first.
No, bad idea.
Now,
I don't look good in red.
The Consulta Medica, again, with the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints, they serve as the legwork of the canonization. They do all of the interviewing, all of the deciding, all of that, and they have to overcome every objection in order for canonization to be considered. Now, while the committee researches the miracles, inevitably they come in contact with men and women of science mm-hmm. and medicine. Again, out of a survey of 600 miracles, it was found that 95% of them were medical healings. In all but two of the files in that the Vatican archive keeps, these medical miracles included interviews. The files on them included interviews with a physician who had been aware of and ideally treating the illness before the miracle. Or if an interview was not available, the doctor was at least listed by name and their medical notes were included into the file. As time went on, the physician was required even more so to participate in the investigation. If they refused, the investigation would not continue. If they simply said, no, I'm not being a part of this, then there was no way to overcome that other than just pestering them.
And that one was just basically eventually thrown out.
Exactly, yes.
As an example of healing.
Yes. If a physician, particularly one with a specific expertise, did not treat the healed individual but knew them personally or professionally, their testimony would also be added to the file. So you'd have their treating doctor and then an expert. And oftentimes these files actually have the testimonies of 8 to 10 different medical experts, anybody who really touched the case at any point. One of the criteria that must be met is that the miracle has to be miraculous.
Right.
This means that almost every report of illness that was healed, whether it's a healing from the 16th century or the 20th, is a healing that is beyond the realm of possibility. Thus, almost every file includes a note that the physician told the experiencer of the miracle that there is nothing to be done. Illness either was incurable and they'd have to live with it, or more often they were terminal and they had little to no time left. Now, secondly, the miracle must take place all at once and not gradually. You're sick one day, through the next day, through some sort of contact with the divine, you are made well. Finally, the miracle has to be durable and long lasting. This is often a claim.
That's how I like them built.
This is often a claim of critics. As I said, you see it all the time here. People get in a religious fervor. They've been in a wheelchair all their days. They can walk. They walk for an hour or two, and then they're back in their wheelchair. The body does really crazy things. It's amazing. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
That is not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here are instances, for instance, individuals who the 70th miracle of Lourdes was not investigated and declared a miracle until 10 years after it occurred to make sure that the healing was a legitimate healing that stuck. And I have more about this somewhere. Okay. But
so I'm getting at is this doesn't happen quickly.
No, it's a very, very, very long process.
Well, then how did John Paul II get...
John Paul II got...
Sainthood so quickly.
He was sanctified. He was canonized very quickly because Pope Benedict, through special dispensation, for one thing, waived the 5-year waiting period that you have to go through to even be considered for sainthood. And secondly, depending on your worldview, from a naturalistic worldview, there were a lot of people praying to him very quickly. So
okay.
You had a special circumstance there. But in the case of Pope John Paul II, his first miracle was the spontaneous healing of a nun who suffered from Parkinson's. The only problem? Parkinson's is incurable.
Right.
So this is a wonderful point where it is often suggested that, and again, it just comes down to your worldview and where you're coming from, if she was healed, it could not have been Parkinson's. So therefore, she was not healed from Parkinson's. She was healed from something else that looks like Parkinson's. It was diagnosed as Parkinson's by her doctor. It was cataloged as thus. And there was, of course, that little file that said, there's nothing we can do. It's Parkinson's.
Right.
So that's one of JP's miracles. The other one is he healed a traumatic brain injury, again, spontaneously. I don't know as much about that.
Okay.
The 70th verified miracle at the Shrine of Lourdes was Burnett Morau, who was able to take a leg brace off that she had worn for 40 years, receiving constant medical attention for due to nerve damage, and walk the next day 5 kilometers with absolutely no problem. The miracle, like I said, was not even verified until 10 years after it occurred, and Morau had never suffered with her leg from that day on. So that's the nature of stuff we're talking about here. It's not like I had the flu and now I'm better.
Right.
It's like I had Parkinson's or my entire left
chronic
leg.
Ailments.
Yes. Yeah. My entire leg was shot. When it comes to sainthood, a miracle can only be confirmed as coming by way of a specific person if the afflicted did not pray to anyone else during their ordeal, as we mentioned. Finally, when it comes to medical miracles, the church will often enlist the help of secular doctors without telling them what's going on. Such was the case for one Jacqueline Duffin, who made a survey of miracles. She's the one who went through those 600 cases we've been mentioning. She made a survey of miracles for the Bulletin of the History of Medicine, Volume 81. We'll be linking to that in our show notes as well. Jacqueline, working as a hematologist, was offered a set of bone marrow aspirates and asked to see what she could learn about them without being given any other information. She diagnosed severe acute leukemia, which over the course of 18 months had gone through a cycle of relapse and remission, and concluded that the patient must have died of the cancer shortly after the samples were taken. She was amazed to learn that in reality, the patient had been miraculously healed, and the miracle was being considered in the case of the canonization of Marie-Marguerite de Youville. Jacqueline's blind findings contributed to Marie-Marguerite being canonized the first Native the first native-born Canadian to be canonized. Thus, the miracles, whether they be medical or having to do with more rarely incorruptibility, like we mentioned with Jacinta, where their bodies don't decay over a number of years, or Marian apparitions, they are at the very least well-researched. But in the case of Marian apparitions, healings are a very big part for this reason. I can't think of a single one that I found in all of my research that did not include at least one, if not a number of healings.
So has Lucy been canonized yet?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe so. And I think that the special dispensation of 5 years was waived for her as well. So we're just waving it all over the place. No,
curiosity.
We're not. Now, we have scientific speculation, medical speculation, biographical speculation that goes into this. There's one last note that's really, for me, really impressive, is that in any sort of, like, especially a Marian apparition, for something to get verified, the message of the apparition and the testimony of the witnesses of the message must be free from doctrinal and theological error, which sounds pretty straightforward, until you realize that, like, the systematic theology of the Catholic Church is like thousands of pages, thousands upon thousands of pages. In fact, you have like Karl Barth, who wrote his Church Dogmatics, which, granted, Barth was a Protestant and writing from a Protestant point of view, his Church Dogmatics was, I think, 8,000 pages. And so take that and then add, like, I don't know, 1,500 years of tradition and doctrine and dogma, and then make it a book. That's what these kids are up against. Thus,
yikes,
for them to be able to create a real, verified apparition of the Virgin or anything like that, they would have to have the know-how to dupe that. I mean, there are people who spend their entire lives just trying to learn all of this,
right,
so that people can call them and be like, hey, is this theologically sound? And they're like, no, of course not. Let me tell you why. And that's what these kids are up against. So you have multiple different gates that these things have to go through before they even get close to, again, being considered for canonization. And then there's a lot of prayer and there's a lot of everything else that goes into it and all of that. But the last thing that they are, and I think we made this point pretty well with Fatima and also Our Lady of Zeton, is that they are not uninvestigated. They are not simply, hey, look, some kid said they saw it, let's go. There's even been consecutive, I'm going to mess this up and say something not true, I'm sure, but so I'll err on the side of caution.
Yeah,
there's
best.
Actually been consecutive Marian apparitions for numbers of years in a place with a name that starts with a G. This is not helpful. Called like Gejurl or something, that are very, very similar to the Fatima apparitions that have been going on for years, and the church has made no judgment on them, despite people crying out and saying, I was there, I saw it, what more do you want? So I just dropped a lot of words on you and at you and around you. What do you think?
I should have brought an umbrella.
Do you have anything?
I do not come from this sort of background,
right,
or knowledge at all. It sound I do like just the level of scrutiny involved with sainthood and canonization.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot.
So I don't. But where are the aliens, Sam?
Oh no, the aliens were last episode.
Okay.
No, this was an alien-free episode for you.
It's just apparitions yeah. and saints.
Yeah,
okay.
This is just this. Like I said, now ideally, you, the listener, can walk away from this saying, "Wow, I know a lot more about this than I did," and maybe you wanted to, and maybe you really didn't care, but you stuck around anyway. I appreciate that about you. You're so good looking.
Cool. And on that note, you can find us on
Facebook, Instagram. Not Instagram. Why do I keep saying Instagram? Twitter. On the internet. Google. Just Google it. Just, I'm at that point, man. Just Google it.
Took you years, but you finally just gave in.
Go to patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn how you can help support the show and join our book club and join our weekly Skype call. Not weekly. Woof. Monthly Skype call. Not Skype call either. Our monthly Facebook Live, and get a thank you note and get stickers and get a note on your birthday, too. Handwritten note. That's right. Birthday cards coming from us.
How about you, right? You can't read his writing?
I can't read or write. But
that bombshell.
All of that is at Not Alone Podcast on Patreon.
Perfect.
Okay.
Lovely. That's what we wanted here.
I'm Catholiced out, man. I didn't think it would happen. I'm not even Catholic out. I'm just Marian apparitioned out.
Perfect.
I hope this served. And I really, guys, I cannot stress enough how much I hope that I did not like offend anybody or make anybody upset. If I did, please, please let me know and call me all sorts of mean names because I deserve it. It's fine.
Don't call them mean names.
Just let me know. We tried to do this as sensitively as we could, but at the end of the day,
positive criticism. All right, like.
Sure, sure. Well, and again, the church has a knack for really digging into these things and speculating and learning. So hopefully we're just following that tradition and not making a lot of people mad. But if we are, you'll definitely...
I mean, the internet, so, you know, probably going to happen anyway.
You'll definitely not be mad next month when we spend the entire month talking about Aleister Crowley, the Lord of Darkness. So, kind of, I thought it'd
Rock
be
on.
Like a nice little counterbalance.
Right,
we
right.
spent this entire month, like, in the area of light and love and God and good, and now we're going to go down modern-day Satanism. So, it'll be a nice little palate cleanser for everybody who thought these episodes weren't as fun.
Perfect.
Remember, whether you are... I don't want to be... sacrilegious. This is not good. Whether you find yourself at the end of a very long rope with nowhere to go, or you find yourself lifted up, joyful, and triumphant, you are not alone.